It's a little after four, so let's call our meeting to order. Do we have a substitute here for, are you a jack of all trades today, Kevin, or?
Just do a quick roll call. Chair Beasley?
Here.
Vice Chairman Latchford?
Here.
Commissioner Newell?
Here.
Commissioner Silverson?
Here.
Commissioner Mason?
Here.
Okay, we have a quorum. Could we have a pledge to allegiance, please?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I don't have any blue cards, so I guess we don't have any called audience tonight. I've been told that Josh is going to be about a half an hour or so late, so I guess what we'll do is when he arrives, we'll have the council liaison report. How about a staff report?
Mr. Chair, I was able to attend the PSPRS presentation last week, so some of the information that we have for presentation tonight will be coming directly from that session that we had with the administrator of the public safety retirement system. They've also completed the model that they've been talking about for over a year. And we did, I got that emailed to me at about 12:30 today. So I've looked at it for about 10 minutes, and we'll also have it available tonight so that we can take some quick looks at it. I don't know how to completely use it yet, but for the next meeting, I'll be more familiar with it. So that's my report for tonight.
Was the meeting pretty well attended?
Mr. Chair, it was. There was, it's a Government Finance Officers Association training, and so there was probably 50 to 60 people there attending the conference.
Good. Okay. We have a review of the last meeting's minutes. Anybody have any comments on this? Do I have a motion?
I would move to accept the minutes from the last meeting, January 21st.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so they're approved. We have a discussion and action on a chair and vice chair for our commission. Because we need to do this on an annual basis. John?
Mr. Chairman, if you're so predisposed, I would move that the commission consider reelecting Jim Beasley as chairman of the commission.
And you as vice chair?
I didn't say. I think we probably.
One motion?
I will second that.
Okay. Any discussion on this? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. I guess we continue as is.
Well, it's very easy to be vice chair because you do so much work, as long as you stay on your bike.
Yeah, keep the wheels down. It's when you're on the ground that's the problem. So. It was brought up that it might be advantageous to change the dates for our meetings so that we would have a bit of a gap between our meetings and the next council meeting. Kevin, I guess it was either you or Mary sent this out to us.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I did attach a calendar that we have for all of our council meetings and our advisory commissions and boards. So you can see where the available spots are. And really, if you're looking to keep it on a Tuesday, either the second Tuesday or the third Tuesday do appear to be the best time. From staff's perspective, there are some challenges. So for example, tonight we're doing the financial update. And if we move the meeting up to the second week, we will just have to delay when the financials get to you. It'll be another month but before you would see them, because we're not done with them. So we're presenting the December financials tonight. And so we probably would not have them available for the February meeting if we did it on the second Tuesday of the month.
Would it have any impact on the budgeting either in terms of our review of materials?
It may. I don't remember the calendar for the budget on which council meetings. Are we taking it to the first or third, do you recall?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, I can pull up the calendar and we can kind of take a look. I think in terms of the monthly financials was really where we were seeing that it would have the most impact. And that would just mean that council would be seeing them first. And then when your meeting would come up, you would be seeing them after council, whereas currently you're seeing them before. But I can pull up the calendar. We have the tentative budget adoption scheduled for the second meeting in May, I believe, and then final adoption the first week in June. So we would probably just kind of have to lay that out and see what impact that might have. I wouldn't envision anything. I mean, I think we can work with that basically. I don't see any, you know, major flags or problems with those dates, but we would have to just kind of glance at it a little closer and see.
And that would potentially change from year to year also when we're presenting it to council on either the first meeting or the second meeting of the month. So yeah. I'd hate to have that be the driving factor of when we try to schedule this meeting. The other issue was also just the time of the meeting. Councilmember Nicholson does have a conflict at 4 o'clock, and he was, when I discussed it with him, he was wanting to have some discussions about potentially moving the meeting a little bit later so that he wouldn't have these conflicts.
Yeah. Well, I would be amenable to moving it a little later. The only question I have is if that's going to put, especially if it's normally scheduled the day before the town council meeting, if that's going to have an impact on staff morale and family time. I know sometimes we go long. I don't want to have, you know, the finance staff go late two nights in a row. I think that's, you know, that would be my concern. So perhaps staff could speak to that if they're comfortable with, you know, if it's a burden to do two back-to-back meetings, or, you know, what are your opinions?
My opinion on it is that whether it's that second week or the third week, and having back-to-back meetings doesn't really impact me, but I'm not going to be here long-term. You know, I think as long as it doesn't start too late, you know, if we could at least start by the 5 o'clock time frame, that would keep it from going too late.
And I did want to mention, I apologize, Mr. Chair, members of the commission, I did misspeak. Our calendar, what we have right now laid out, is tentative for the first meeting in June and then final for the second meeting in June. So June 3rd and June 17th. And then there are a couple of study sessions as well that occur in May.
So we will see the budget starting in May or April?
We have currently, Mr. Chair, we have May 6th as when the recommended budget would be presented to council. So just looking at that picture, you would be provided with a copy of the budget as well. But then it looks like your first meeting where you discuss the budget, so we do have that on our calendar for Tuesday, May 19th. So that would just be theoretically pushed up to, I guess that would be May 11th. So I don't really see a big impact there. We have, like I said, a tentative budget work session at the end of May, and then the two meetings in June, June 3rd and June 17th for tentative and final.
I see the mayor is in the room. May I ask him a question with regard to if we change our meeting, moving it forward? Do you have any opinions with regard to whether that helps or hurts communications as far as council is concerned?
Like everything, Chair Beasley, there's probably pros and cons. I mean, there may be some things that actually, as I was sitting here listening to the conversation, maybe there's some items that actually could be pushed back instead of being brought to the council. I mean, there would be some circumstances where that's not possible, is my guess. But that may be a possibility in terms of just scheduling an item, knowing that it's being reviewed by this commission, rather than maybe we can push that out so that it's not the night before a commission or a council meeting is one possibility, but I mean, that's just a thought. I don't know what the reality of that is. There's certainly benefit in having the commission's feedback, input on particular items that come before the council. If it's the night before, it's the night before. I really leave it to staff to try to, you know, see what the options are, and then we do the best we can.
And Mr. Chair, for some of the more recent items that we've brought forward, like the permanent base adjustment and the pension funding, we're trying to roll that into the calendar of your meetings so that we do have adequate time when it comes to council. So on those items where we have a little bit of time to plan, I don't think it really helps or hurts staff, whether it's the second meeting or the second Tuesday of the month or the third Tuesday of the month, as long as we have some time to plan for that and we can schedule accordingly. So I don't see from staff's perspective that it helps having it on that second Tuesday, to be honest.
How much time do you need if we make a recommendation that you could present it to mayor and council at their?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Mason, Commissioner Mason, the agenda packet goes out for council a week before the meeting. So if we had our meeting on the second Tuesday, that packet is going out the next day. So we wouldn't have enough time to get something to that next council meeting anyway, typically. If it's something that we knew about and could have a template of the council report drafted and just drop some information in, then we could. But there's a review process that we have to go through, and so it most likely go to the first meeting of the following month.
Thank you.
Am I hearing ain't broke, don't fix it, or where are we?
I think the only thing possible would be, you know, and I'd want to talk to Josh and hear his input if 5 o'clock makes more sense for him.
That's fine.
Agree.
So maybe when Josh gets here, we'll just take a look at the time.
Okay. So maybe we could just table the item until Councilmember Nicholson arrives. And
it's kind of what I'm hearing at this point.
Was it when we were
reviewing the budget that this came up. I feel like this came up a while back, and there was something we were specifically discussing that we were concerned about the timing of our input.
I think there was a number of things that we were wondering whether if we were able to give a greater gap between our discussion and the council, it would provide more information to council so that they could deliberate more effectively. But I'm not really hearing that. Am I wrong?
Well, I think we're getting information that it would need to be at least a week earlier than the second. You would need 2 weeks in order to prepare things ready to get things there.
And there are other commissions
right. That
are in the way.
Right.
So sounds like we're locked into the dates question of time.
Okay.
So when Josh gets here, why don't we bring this back?
So, Mr. Chair, I think that since we're moving on from this, I'll formally move to table this to later in the agenda.
Okay. Do we need a
second?
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. You have a financial update for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. I'm pleased to be presenting our mid-year fiscal year 1920 update through December. I am pleased to announce that things continue to look very positive and stable in all of our funds, with continued revenue growth and expenditures trending at or under budget for this time of year. First, just wanted to start off with a pie chart, just to give you an idea of the percentage of funds that we're discussing tonight. This is our fiscal year 1920 budget by fund, with the dollar figures shown by fund and our fund type and as a percentage of the total budget. The funds we are going to be talking about tonight are in color, and so you can see them all there. In total, they represent just over 70% of our adopted budget. So first, we have our general fund in green there at almost $41 million, or 37% of our total budget. Next largest fund would be our water utility fund at just under $23 million, or 20% of our budget. And then the smaller funds that we're also discussing tonight, our community center fund, $6.7 million, or 6%. The highway fund, just over $4 million, or 4%. And then the stormwater utility fund there in the beige tan color at $4 million, also 4% there as well. Just diving into some of our general fund revenues and touching on where we were at this point in the fiscal year. Again, everything is looking very positive. Our local sales taxes, you can see our actuals compared to budget there. Percentage of budget, 52.7. That's a great sign, just in light of the fact that we don't quite have all the Christmas sales reflected in these numbers as well. And we also see a bit of a boost in the spring, just with snowbirds and that sort of thing. So these are trending very strong. Mostly those collections are trending over due to construction sales tax. And then we are seeing the full impact of the recent legislation for remote sellers. So retail remote sellers are now all required to submit retail sales tax. Our state shared revenues are trending as expected on budget there. They're just over $6 million, or about 49% through December. The charges for services are trending well. Also, there is some seasonality in that revenue source, and so typically we would expect a little more as we start warming up again with our aquatic center, some of our summer program revenues that we see towards the end of May and June when kids get out of school, and so we're confident those are trending on budget as well. Our license and permits are looking excellent at just under $1.3 million, or about 64% of budget. That's due to activity that we're seeing both in the residential and commercial side. So activity has been strong in both those sectors. And then finally, all of our other revenue sources at just under $1.3 million, or about 43% of budget. Those are items such as our state and federal grants, some of our intergovernmental revenues, the IGA that we have with the RTA for transit services, transfers, interest income, and that sort of thing.
Just one quick question, excuse me. How long does it take to get your sales tax from the state? So, like, for example, you mentioned December. When would you receive your December allocation of sales tax from the state?
It should be. So our when we get our December sales tax report, we usually get it by mid-year January. But what they call December is, I believe, actually activity from November returns. So I think it's about 45 days, if I remember correctly. So there will be a bit of a period after the fiscal year ends where we'll be accruing that activity, making those adjustments.
If I remember, when you reported that you put together this budget, you were anticipating some general economic slowdown during this fiscal year compared to the previous year, going to the end of the economic expansion and into a not necessarily a recession, but a slowdown. Are these numbers that you're seeing in line with what you would normally see the previous year with a continued expansion, or is this good news, something different above and beyond normal expansionary economic activity?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Newell, I don't know if I would call it in excess or an expansion, but it just what we're seeing, I think, is just stable, you know, reflected continued growth. All trends look positive so far. So we are definitely, you know, keeping our finger on the pulse and watching for any signs of a slowdown or any kind of trends that we're seeing. But we don't see that as of right now. So in total, our general fund revenues through December were just over $20 million, or about 51.1% of our $39.4 million budget. On the expenditure side for the general fund, our total expenditures are estimated to come in under budget at year-end by just over 1%, or just over $500,000. That is due to personnel savings that we are estimating, and those are estimated at about $566,000. That's partially offset with some overages that we're anticipating that we had expected in Department O&M and Capital, and that's about $61,000. That's due primarily to contracted services. So on the personnel savings side, a little bit of context here, we do have some vacancies that are currently being filled by contracted interim folks, and so that is the reason for the considerable personnel savings you see there, and then the offset with the O&M for contracted services. Our estimated year-end fund balance in the general fund, just over $20 million, or 47.8% of budgeted expenditures. And as a reminder to the commission, our policy is 25%, so things looking very good there. This is the chart that we typically present for the funds. Our general fund through December. You can see on the chart the prior year actuals are in gray. The current year actuals are in the orange color, and then the budget is in blue. And so you can see on the revenue side, revenues up about 4% from where they were last fiscal year. On the expenditure side, those are up just under 5%, about 4.8% at $19.6 million. Just to note, those actuals do include the $500,000 payment that we made to PSPRS to go towards our unfunded liability. So those are reflected in the actuals there. Moving on to the highway fund, on the revenue side, our state-shared highway user revenues are expected to come in over budget by just under $200,000, and that's due to a one-time allocation that was approved in the state budget. It's a flat amount that all cities and towns are getting, so that has come our way. Expenditures, at this time, we are still estimating those to come in on budget, and we'll continue to watch those and adjust as necessary throughout the rest of the fiscal year. Our estimated year-end fund balance in the highway fund expected to come in at about $818,000. Again, the
The one-time allocation, is that something that you know about before the budgeting process starts, or is that just a surprised it's a lucky day?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Silverson, that was included in the recommended budget for fiscal year 1920 and was adopted by council. So that was wrapped into the budget. It was a planned payment towards PSPRS.
No, I'm talking about the additional funding that we're getting from the state.
Oh, I'm sorry, for the HERF.
Right.
Oh, I'm very sorry. You know, I think that may have come in at the tail end as a later amount that we had not quite known with certainty when the budget was adopted.
Is that common that they would? It seems like a pretty big chunk.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Silverson, we've been actually fairly fortunate with some of those collections lately, you know, in terms of just trying to restore some of those sweeps that we had seen from HERF after the fallout with the recession. And so there's been, through legislation, some fiscal years where cities and towns have received an additional allocation. So this has occurred before in the past. Here's the chart for the highway fund. Again, things looking positive here as well. Revenues up at $2.1 million over last fiscal year compared to $1.8 million. Expenditures up just slightly at $1.5 million compared to $1.4 million last fiscal year. In the community center fund, covering the revenues, our contracted revenues are estimated to come in over budget by about 4%, or $128,000. That's based on Troon's current forecast through the end of the fiscal year. Our town operating revenues are still estimated at budgeted levels by fiscal year end. And again, we'll continue to watch those and adjust those if necessary. Our half-cent sales tax revenues, we are expecting those to come in over budget by just over 2%, or $55,000. That's due mainly to those retail collections that we're seeing from those remote sellers. So those are fairly sizable and seeing the full impact of that now. On the expenditure side, our contracted expenditures are estimated under budget by about 2%, or just over $100,000. Again, that is based on the current Troon forecast. Those savings are due to several areas, but it is primarily personnel savings that they are estimating at this point in time. Our town operating expenditures are still estimated at budgeted levels by fiscal year end. In conclusion, for the Community Center Fund, we are expecting a surplus of just under $600,000 and an ending fund balance of about $1.1
million. Just a couple questions. With the community fund, I know we've already established that this, you have a $750,000 subsidy limit for the golf side. What is your calculation to determine if you hit that? Is it just your contracted revenues less your contracted expenditures, and if that's under $750,000, or what's the calculation you're going to use?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Mason, that is going to occur for next fiscal year. So this current fiscal year, there wasn't a $750,000 or any subsidy target for the current fiscal year. For next fiscal year, what council adopted was what we called Variation B, and it's actually a little bit different than the $750,000 it was in the first year. I think upwards of a little over $800,000 or $900,000. But to answer your question, so basically at the end of each fiscal year, we will have to go back and look at that and perform that calculation based on what the revenues were, what the contracted expenditures were, and see where we're at in relation to that goal.
If you come... Well, let's say it's $800,000 that year and you come under that. Does the golf side keep that fund balance, or is it just if you're under, you're under, but you don't necessarily need to keep it? Or if you went over, you'd have to make it up the next year. So what's the policy there?
Commissioner Mason, there wasn't actually a lot of discussion if we came under what would – it would stay in the fund because it's a special revenue fund. So if we do come in under budget, those dollars will stay in the fund. But as far as the accounting for them, if that goes as a credit to the next year, we really haven't had those discussions on what it means to the subsidy on a year-by-year basis. But the funds definitely will stay in the community center fund.
Okay. And just I was just looking at the statement, and you show about $265,000 being transferred out of the community fund. Where does that go?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Mason, $120,000 of that goes to the general fund, and that's to repay the loan that the general fund provided to the community center fund when we first began operations. And so that is an annual amount that we budget every year. And then the rest of the difference, which is about $150,000, is a transfer to our municipal debt service fund, and that's to pay the principal and interest on our energy efficiency bonds that we issued for improvements at the community center.
So how much left is the loan to the general fund before it's paid off?
I believe this is year 3 of 10. I can get back to you on that with a definite, but I think this is, I believe this is year 3 of 10.
So it was a 10-year loan, basically.
Okay. Yes, I will double-check on that. I'm almost positive it was a 10-year.
Okay, thank you.
And Commissioner Mason, if I can just add also to your previous question, so if there is savings on that subsidy, as I mentioned, it'll stay in the fund, but then that will also go towards the policy of pay-as-you-go funding for capital projects. So it would go towards the pay-as-you-go financing that we're implementing.
You're not trying to divide it between the community center and the golf? Are you trying to keep some sort of a division there so you kind of know what the fund balance is between the two activities within the fund, or is you just kind of going to keep it all together?
Yeah, we do not break out the fund balance between the community center or the golf. It's all the community center fund, so all of the activities are in that fund.
Okay, thanks.
Moving on to the chart for the Community Center Fund through December, just looking at our revenue side, revenues at $3.1 million compared to $3 million last fiscal year. That's about a 3% growth. On the expenditure side, expenditures at $3.3 million for the current year versus $3.1 million at this point in time last fiscal year. That's about a 6.5% increase. Finally, the Water Utility Fund and the Stormwater Utility Fund, we always wrap our two enterprise funds into the mid-year financials just to give you a picture of how they're doing and also in light of the fact that the Water Utility Fund is a sizable fund in our budget. On the revenue side, excluding our bond proceeds, our year-end revenue estimates are anticipated slightly under budget by just over $500,000. That is due to water sales, lower water consumption from increased rainfall. So that is the reason for the variance there. Our expenses are estimated under budget by $1.8 million. That's about 8%. And that is due largely to several CIP projects that they have going on, either cost savings associated with some of those projects or expected rollovers for projects that will continue into the following fiscal year. In our Stormwater Utility Fund, our revenues are estimated under budget by $2.1 million, and that is strictly due to a grant-funded CIP project that we had placed in the budget. I believe it's our Catalina Ridge Channel Repair Project. We had received notification that that funding was not moving forward, and so that estimate reflects that. And then our expenses are estimated under budget by 2.1 as well, and that's just tied to the corresponding CIP project. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Well, Wendy, thanks for a good presentation there and a lot of good information. And a couple of questions, and one little minor one comes up in the community fund. And that is, I don't see the revenue being posted for the tennis facility. Is that something that needs to be caught up, or is that something that has been shifted somewhere else? I know it's not a very large number, but it throws off your comparables a little bit year to year.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Latchford, so those revenues are coming in strictly as rental revenues to the town. So those revenues don't flow through us anymore. Basically, what we're seeing is rental payments from the individual who now operates the tennis program.
Right.
So that going? Those should be, let me just flip to that fund, but... So those revenues are basically reflected in our town operating revenues under facility rental income is where we would be seeing those come in to the fund.
It's just a minor variance. It's going to cause with your budget if you... so that's fine. I'm just pointing that out. I note that, moving on to another subject matter, that the council is looking at planning and impact fees. That's before it. Which eventually will have to go out to the public. Do we have any idea as to what the impact financially will be to the town once those are implemented? Have we done any type of financial analysis of what the amount might be?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, I believe the impact fees are proposed to go up around 4 to 5%. So we currently have impact fees in place. We are simply updating our study, and so we believe that the impact to the town will be similar to what it's been in past years, that our collections will be very similar with the 4% increase overall in the overall fee.
So you don't anticipate that there'll be any kind of impact that would decrease those revenues because people find it too expensive or whatever?
No, I do not believe that our impact fees are going up to a level that would discourage growth coming here. I believe the 4% increase over a five-year period when construction costs have likely gone up 25 to 30% in that same time frame, that our increase is very reasonable.
So the effective rate would be about 4% of that revenue?
I believe that was the overall number was about 4% increase. Let me see if I have my... No, I don't have a copy of my report here, but okay. As I recall, that's the ballpark that the total increase is.
When was the last time it went up?
The last increase would have been in 2014, or the last update to the study was in 2014.
But as you prepare for the budget for the coming year, then the that 4% will certainly be, will that be included, or... in terms of an increase over the prior year?
Mr. Vice Chair, yes. We will take into account if council adopts those new fees, we will take that into account through the budget process, and when we project the number of homes to be built, it will be based on that new impact fee.
Okay. All right, and I do know it's still being pending then. There's other steps to take before it becomes a reality, but I was just curious what the impact would be. On another subject, I think I read in the write-up somewhere that general fund expenditures are projected to be $500,000 below plan, and this is primarily due to personnel vacancy. And it got me wondering about whether we're seeing impact from the current marketplace. Undoubtedly, I know in the past that the way we do the budget, we carry 100% of the cost. I'm agreeable with that. That's very conservative. But is $500,000 comparable to what's been in the past years, or is that more than what we've seen in past years? And is that because the labor market, which is very tight, we all see the same news, wondering whether that had any impact on our hiring ability or staffing ability here within the organization?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Latchford, I would say it's not really related to that to a large extent. Primarily, Some of the areas, for example, that are driving some of those savings, as I mentioned, we have had a couple of kind of high-level vacancies that are currently being filled on a contracted interim basis. And then we also had some new positions in the budget this fiscal year. For example, on the police department side, three new officers and a sergeant were approved in the budget. We always, in order to be conservative, we always budget a full fiscal year of personnel salaries, in order to be conservative. And those positions weren't quite filled as of July 1st, and so there were some savings there as well. So I would say it's just a number of things, but I wouldn't necessarily tie it to market conditions as driving it.
So putting aside the financial impact, this labor market's not really, is it creating any problems for us on staffing or challenges, I guess is the right word?
Mr. Mayor, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, we are definitely seeing some challenges in recruitments in a couple of key targeted areas. Senior level folks, particularly, it's challenging to attract, and you know, we've lost offers and that sort of thing. We're also seeing impacts in our ability to attract police officers right now, and I think that is a trend that is also happening across other, for a variety of reasons, some of which are controllable on our part, and we'll be looking at things like compensation and that sort of thing in the coming fiscal year. But minimum wage increase has caused some compression issues for us, as that has happened now over the past 3 years. And while we made some adjustments in the current fiscal year, you know, it just went up again. And so that is something that when you get everything kind of squished at the bottom, we're going to have to look at how we try to address those issues in the future. And then there are some specific professional level positions that have been challenging to recruit for. So in other areas, we still get lots and lots of applications. And, you know, Oro Valley continues to have a great reputation as a desirable place to work. So if it's, you know, kind of our mainstream positions, we're not really struggling with all that much, except for the police officer area. And as you know, if you want to be a police officer, there's a lot of qualifications you got to meet as well. I mean, it's a pretty high bar for sure. But it's something that we continue to have our finger on the pulse to see what we need to change in order to stay competitive in the marketplace.
I think from the perspective of the commission, I'm trying to tie the elements together, but I think the fact that the town is looking at its fee structure in the hopes of raising more revenue, while at the same time having to deal with these potential increasing costs, I know full well what compression means, and having dealt with it in the past, these are real costs, they're not theories, and so the fact that we're looking at that, we may have to see some increased costs coming through in the budget for the coming year. So I think it's good to see that these activities are occurring so that we can meet these increased costs with the opportunity for perhaps, if everything is approved, I know mm-hmm. we're still pending, that we are looking to balance out over the course of the coming year of the budget. It makes it tougher, but I'm glad to see these activities at least occurring.
I do want to mention, Mr. Vice Chair, that impact fees are not available for use in the general fund. They're specifically set aside only for one-time purchases to invest in infrastructure needed as a result of new growth. So if we don't grow, then we don't need that infrastructure. And so theoretically, we wouldn't need to collect those money because we wouldn't be building what it is we were planning to build. Right. So it's a little bit different, but we should be looking at a number of our different fees in the future, and always be prepared to address the market and increasing costs and that sort of thing.
I absolutely agree with you. You headed me off the path there, because I do think that we're, at least based on what we know today, that the economy and being as strong as it is, and the labor market being as tough as it is for an employer, that we will have to look at additional actions for revenue. So anyway, thank you very much for those questions and answers.
And Mr. Vice Chair, I just looked at the development fee report. The residential fees are 1% higher, not the 4% that I mentioned earlier. The retail commercial is proposed to be 48% higher, and the office and industrial is an 11% decrease. So
those are impact fees?
Those are the impact fees that we were talking about earlier, and the percentage increase or decrease for them.
And we had a consulting firm, I believe, put that all together. Is that?
That's correct.
And 48% in retail. That's, I know they go through quite a bit of activity to come up with that number. It seems pretty impressive. So I guess time will tell whether it was or wasn't. I have no other questions along that line.
I have one quick question on the attachment C3, which is the restaurant operations. I can see some of the food and beverage revenues related to attachment C1, but I can't see the breakout of the rest of the expenses on C1 to make comparison to C3. So where are we actually at? We've got $65,000 worth of losses year to date.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, attachment C3 is specific solely to the food and beverage operations. So if you were looking at C3, that would be just those operations. C1, yes, we do have food and beverage revenues.
We have revenues, but we don't have it broken out any other place.
That's correct, yeah. On the summary page for attachment C1, expenditures are summarized by category.
Okay. So can I interpret this to say that we're anticipating on a budget to lose about $130,000 this year, 50% of the year?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if we can just take this trend and double it, only because when they get into the spring, that is their kind of busy season with golfers and that sort of thing. And so if anything, I would probably expect that trend to improve before we end the fiscal year. And Mr. Chair, if I may, I did have a chance just to verify the loan to the Community Center Fund from the General Fund. It is a 10-year loan. We did do a transfer. Let's see. Fiscal year 16-17, 17-18, 18-19. So 19-20 will actually be our fourth payment.
Okay. Just a couple other quick questions on for golf. You have kind of a breakout for member dues for member play. Is there a breakout for non-member play?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Mason, if I am looking at this correctly, I believe the figure that's non-member would be the golf revenues.
Just, so that's non-member. Okay. Now, just a procedural question. From the viewpoint of Troon, is Troon spending city money, or does Troon spend its money and we reimburse it, and then that's when we put it into the county system? Or how does that process work?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Mason, they basically have a separate account that they operate from, and when they need a subsidy to process their payroll or process their AP, we typically do transfers into their account in order to make those payments.
So are we putting, so any transactions that they record in their system, we don't have in ours at all, or do we have it summary, or is it, how does that work?
Commissioner Mason, no, we do record those in our system. Those are we book those as transfers to Troon, so they are recorded in our system.
So you're not, they're not broken out by types of expenditures or types of revenues?
No,
or?
No, it is not, Commissioner Mason. It's at the summary level.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Quickly. And this has nothing to do with the numbers. It's more about the results of where we are at the moment. But council does have a policy in which 25% of operating expenditures are set aside as a minimum reserves. And then calculation, I know everybody runs through their head, but where do we stand at the moment with that, with the results that we've got through December? That is, we more than cover the minimum reserve requirements under the policy, but how much is in excess of that? I guess what you probably would call excess unrestricted reserves. Do you have a calculation of that?
If you give me just a minute, Vice Chair Latchford, I can pull that up. Let's see. Grab our final. Okay, yes, sorry about that. I just had to do some quick calculations here. So our expenditures for fiscal year 18-19 were about $39.6 million. And our ending fund balance was just under $19.6 million. So I calculate that as about 49% for the ending fund balance as a percentage of actual expenditures.
So our excess reserves would then be, you're saying, 49% of the balance. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So the
24%. So it'd be 20. So the 25% is the required minimum. So we would have an additional 24% above that.
Okay. What's the size of that 24%? I think is what you're asking.
Probably about $9 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Approximately $9 million. But there are some other restrictions or assignments in fund balance. So when we went through the CAFR presentation at the last meeting, we had already programmed to spend some of our fund balance in this current year budget. So that's already showing as an assignment of fund balance. So I believe our unassigned fund balance was about $4 million. $4 million for the last fiscal year.
And Mr. Vice Chair, kind of the way that we do it is as those resources then are evaluated during the budget process and incorporated just as they were this past year into, my final budget recommendation to council as one-time resources used for one-time investments. And so that's exactly what we'll do that the same way this year, evaluate what is the amount that's available for programming, and then it will be applied or transferred into the capital improvement, the CIP fund or that sort of thing. The goal is that yes, there are year-end fund or year-end excess funds because we either bring in more money or we don't spend, and those are dedicated specifically for the either capital or PSPRS. But that intent of moving it off and into the capital fund is the appropriate response because it's not just part of a fund balance. It's not part of this 25%. We're going to utilize those funds appropriately for investments that are priorities of the council and the community.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's always important we be very conscious of that because it's very tempting to look at what is happening with the monthly statements and to consider that we are doing really well and we've got all of this reserve sitting out there. And I have heard in other venues that that's available and it may not be. So it might be helpful if we would see that calculation, you know, monthly, if that's okay. Just to get an idea, and it keeps us in perspective of what we're looking at there, particularly with the general fund. What is really available, I think, is really what we're getting to. So if that's okay, I'm with the commission. Thank you.
Any other questions? Good. Thank you very much. We have our council liaison with us now.
Apologies.
So I guess we've got two items that involve you. One would be to give us the council liaison comments, and then we'd like to get back into our discussion on the timing of our meetings relative to council meetings and I guess what might be your request to change the time of our meeting.
Yeah, I apologize. I didn't meet the first half of the meeting. I'm supposed to work till 5. I took an hour off work, and it took me 50 minutes to drive here, unfortunately. But, yeah, for council liaison position, obviously we are going into the next budget season. Two things high on my eyes are the golf and obviously PSPRS. I guess I missed part of the conversation there on probably either one or both of those subjects, but
you haven't missed anything in the pension yet.
Nothing in the pension yet. Okay. as far as anything else, I don't know, do you guys have questions for me or?
Well, do you have a report as far as council communications to us?
No, I don't have anything prepared. Sorry.
Okay.
The report.
We did have a discussion a little bit earlier on the issue of changing the dates for our meetings and whether it would be advantageous to move our meetings a week forward to provide more of a time gap if we might be delivering some recommendations to town council. But I think what we heard, and jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's probably not going to make any difference for the ability of getting information to the council based on the timing with which it has to be delivered.
Mr. Carey, would you entertain a motion to take from the table our discussion regarding the time of the meeting?
Okay, absolutely.
There you go. And in the absence of our attorney or parliamentarian, I believe that needs to be seconded and voted on.
Okay. I have a second. No,
well, just we just to want open people to talk item. About it.
No, we want to just bring it back up again.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Now, if in theory, we're legal.
So, yeah, with my work schedule on Tuesdays, I did swap with someone so I can work 9 to 5s, but that's as early as I can legally from my Monday shifts. But I do have to take like 2 hours off of work to try and get here by 4 o'clock. So a later time, I mean, if I don't take any leave, I could be here by 5:30 generally on Tuesdays. And then Wednesdays are just council sessions. So as long as it's not on a council session day, I can potentially even do 3:30s on those days to be legal, or, you know, 5 shift or starting this at 5 or 4 o'clock would work as well, generally. My Thursday and Fridays are always kind of a mess. Can be different days, different days.
5:30 or 6 would be easier for me, but again, I'd go back to staff and just ask if that's putting an undue burden with a later start time.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Newell, I mean, from staff's perspective, I think staff prefers the earlier time,
sure.
But we can obviously work around the schedule of the commissioners and the council liaison.
I mean, Wednesdays I could do earlier times, so I can work a 7 to 3. I'm legal to work a 7 to 3 shift, so I could get off at 3 and then get here by. I could be here by 4 for sure. I mean, I could get there at 3:40-ish.
Well, I think we have essentially the requirement of doing it on a Tuesday because of when other commission meetings take place.
Okay.
So I think Tuesday is going to be it.
Okay.
And I think with our prior discussion, we figured out that ain't broke, don't fix it, so keep the third Tuesday of every month. Is that
that's what we're here?
So
then it's now the question of whether we should change the time of our meetings and move them from 4 o'clock to something else to accommodate everybody. So I'm hearing from you that you'd kind of like to have it at 5:30 or 6 o'clock.
I mean, we can continue having it at 4. I just can't promise that I can be here at 4 o'clock. It's just dependent on... Like today, we just had to train, and we had to get our hours training a certain student. They couldn't let me leave on time. I'm willing to take the 2 hours off of work. I don't mind doing that. It's just whether my boss is willing to let me leave, which they're usually pretty lenient, but we're at, like, essentially emergency staffing levels, and we have to get people training. So it may be for hopefully by the summertime it'd relax up, and maybe we have enough certified controllers that they're allowing me to leave at 3 o'clock. But
what's everybody thinking?
Well, I think the counterweight is staff time. I mean, they'll have to spend another night here.
I agree.
And I know they exist to service.
I would just.
I'm on your side.
I would just leave it at 4. And just.
I'm just curious, can the council liaison call in and still. Fulfill its,
I can do that, yeah.
Can do that.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, it takes an hour to drive here, so, I mean, if you're okay with me doing the council report towards the middle or the end, I can definitely listen. You know, and a lot of times when I'm at work, too, I'm having to do type training reports or something to that effect where I can...
So you would be able to call in at 4?
Yeah, that would actually be a good
and be fine
adjustment, yeah.
Can you assure us that you're going to hands-free only and be on mute?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's good. Keep it.
Yeah, that sounds like a good compromise.
Okay, I think we solved the non-problem, right?
If it doesn't work, then let us know.
If it doesn't work, we'll take another look at it.
Okay, yeah, that would work good for me, too. So.
All right, so we'll just keep everything as is.
Okay.
You can call in, and hopefully we can hear you, and you can hear us.
Yeah, well, technically, I probably won't be doing much talking while...
Technically, I don't know how much talking you're supposed to be doing, but
until
your staff report, so that might be a good idea to just keep you on mute.
Yeah, if we do a staff report when I get here, that'd be perfect.
Okay. So I don't think we need to do anything on that basis.
Nope.
Okay. All right. Kevin, you have a discussion item for us so that we can start getting into the pension funding policy.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Let me get my presentation up.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, wanted to start just to go back in and review the tasking memo just very quickly from the town manager. So the manager did request that the commission review the PSPRS funding pension funding policy and make a recommendation to the town council. And we are asking that that occur by our March meeting so that we have time to make that recommendation to council and then get it into the budget for next year. So as far as tonight's discussion, what I attempted to do in the staff report is pick out some of the tables that I thought were relevant and meaningful and try to summarize some of that information. But if there is additional information that I didn't cover in the staff report, staff is here tonight to address any of the items that are in the actuarial report. But just to start, again, the current funding policy that was adopted in June of 2019 was that council's goal was to have 100% funding by June 30th, 2036. And some of the objectives to accomplish that are to maintain the annual required contribution payment from operating revenues, retain the 20-year amortization period instead of moving it to the 30-year, to review local board practices annually, apply the newly adopted financial policies where we dedicate surplus funds at year end towards either the capital funds or reducing the unfunded liability, and then also an additional payment towards that unfunded liability. And for fiscal year 1920, this did include that additional lump sum payment of $500,000 that has been made. So that's our current existing pension funding policy. And what we're looking at doing is updating that policy and then taking a recommendation back to council sometime in April. So just to give you some high-level information, we do have two different pension trust funds with the PSPRS systems. One is for our Oro Valley Police Department, and then we also have a separate fund for the dispatchers. So most of my report was really focusing on the police side of it, since it's the majority of our assets and our liability. But for the police department, we currently have, as of June 30th, 2019, we had $37.8 million of assets. The accrued liability was $62.2 million, leaving an unfunded actuarial accrued liability of about $24.4 million. So the funding ratio for our police fund is 60.8%, and that is for the pension and the health side. So that includes both. For the dispatchers, our assets are $1.4 million. The liability is $3.2, leaving an unfunded liability of $1.8 million. And the funding ratio for the dispatchers is 44%.
Just a quick question. Are all dispatchers for all municipalities under the same pension as Oro Valley's is?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Mason, the town manager was just mentioning that most of the dispatchers have transitioned over to the ASRS system. Okay. But again, this is just for the Oro Valley dispatchers. So other dispatchers from Tucson or Marana, if they were in the PSPRS system, would have their own trust fund. But this is just for ours.
All right. Thank you.
So again, focusing in on the police trust fund, just some historical information here going back to 2013. So in 2013, the plan was 75% funded, and the unfunded liability was a little over $7.5 million. The town's contribution to the pension system was 19.3%, And then just some additional information, the rate of return in that given year was 10.9%. So as you can see, over the past 6 or 7 years there, the funding status decreased from 75% down to a low of 59.9% last year. And our unfunded liability has increased from $7.5 million to a little over $24 million in this current year. Again, the other interesting information here is this rate of return. And so you can see over this seven-year period, there has been actually 3 years where the actual rate of return exceeded the assumed rate of 7.4% in the past, which is now 7.3%. And then there's been 4 years where it did not meet our assumed rate of return. On page 2 of the report, it goes into some detail about what our contribution rate was at June 30th, 2018. So our contribution rate was 38.26%. And then the report goes into some detail on what caused our rate to increase to the 41.62% for the pension side of it. So the asset experience, which is our rate of return, that caused our contribution rate to go up 0.28%. So since we did not hit that assumed rate of 7.3%, we were at 6.7%. Since we did not meet that assumed rate, our contribution rate now for the next fiscal year is going up as a result of that. The payroll base is increasing our contribution rate by 1.75%. This is something that until I went to this training last week, I didn't really have a good handle on what the impact of this is. But what the system does is it assumes that our payroll base is going to increase by 3.5% every year. So then they assume that our contributions are going to increase by 3.5% every year. So what has happened over the last 10 years is our payroll base has only gone up on average 1% per year. So the system is assuming that it's going up, that our payroll base is increasing, which then increases the amount of the contributions we make. And so since the system is not getting those increased contributions, that's impacting our contribution rate for this fiscal year. So it's another one of the assumptions. So it's just like the assumption on the rate of return being 7.4%. They're assuming that our payroll base is going to grow 3.5% every single year, and it just has not historically done that and likely won't be doing that.
How, now that you have that information, looking at projecting forward, do you think you might have the ability to project what that payroll base increase might be year to year?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Newell, the model that they gave us that we'll go over after the presentation does give us the ability to change that payroll base rate and show the impact on rate and funded status. So okay, we'll be able to make some of those changes. They've also identified one of the potential changes they're going to make in the future is to allow, there's a potential that they'll allow each community to decide what they want that payroll base increase to be. So right now it's 3.5% for every employer in the state. They're considering letting each community choose their own payroll base. So that's something that the town could look at in the future if we believe a 1% growth rate is more realistic, which I do believe is accurate, then we could make that change. But if you do, it's going to significantly increase our contribution rate because now it's just a balancing act. They're assuming that they're getting it through the 3.5%. If we decrease that bucket, it has to come to them another way, and that's through our contribution rates. So,
or additional payments.
Additional payments through our contribution rates, yes.
We don't really have any means of changing any of these assumptions that are in the report on how they compute. It's we can have our opinion, but really when it comes down to it, they decide what's used for assumptions when they build the actuarial report, which spits out what we have to pay, basically.
Yes, Commissioner Mason, currently that is accurate. So we have no control over any of the assumptions they make. Again, what they discussed at the training last week was they're considering an option to allow communities to have some input. So if we wanted to have a different assumption as far as our rate of return, we could potentially do that if they implement this legislation that would allow us to do that. But there is an impact to that because, if you're not getting it in the rate of return, then it's going to be coming in through the contribution rate. So if we decrease the assumed rate of return, our annual contribution rate is going to go up to make up that dollar difference. So the next item is the liability experience. There was a typo in the report. In the actuarial report, it said that the liability experience was unfavorable, but it was actually a favorable number. So our experience from basically there were some additional retirements that occurred during this actuarial period, and so their calculation of the liability was actually a favorable adjustment for us. So our rate is actually going down 1.24% based on their calculations of our liabilities in the system as a whole. They then made some assumption changes. They changed the assumed interest rate from 7.4% to 7.3%, so a tenth of a percent decrease in the assumed interest rate. And they also adjusted the life expectancy tables. And so they used some updated tables that increased the life expectancy. So the combination of those two items, again, increased our contribution rate by 2.6%. Because they lowered the assumed interest rate and then they extended the life expectancy, that's causing our rate to go up so that we're recovering more of those costs. And then there was a change for other 0.5%. So that you factor all of those items in and it's an overall increase of our rate going from 38.26% to 41.62%. on the pension side. And then over here is the health numbers. So same information here. It's just such a relatively small percentage of the payment. I won't go through each one of those items there. And then the same information for our funding status. So as of June 30, 2018, our funded status was 59.9%. Again, because that assumed interest rate, we did not hit that number, that caused our funding ratio to go down 0.4%. The liability experience, again, was positive, so that increased our funding ratio by 0.2%. The assumption changes that they made, again, being the decrease of the interest rate from 7.4 to 7.3% and the life expectancies decreased our funding status by 1.6%. And then the other category increased our funding by 2.7%. And let me get to that. Let's see if I have an explanation on that one. The report just stated that it was as a result of the transition of actuarial services from, so the actuary changed from GRS to Foster and Foster. So there must have been some methodologies that they changed and that changed our funding status. But the report doesn't go into any details of really what that is.
And where would your best guess of where the payroll growth not happening fall under? From there.
That does not impact the funded status, but that does impact the contribution rate. So that falls here in that payroll base.
So there wouldn't be anything that you would. Okay.
So moving on to the next table, this is on page 4 of the report. So our total normal cost for the pension, so if we were 100% funded, what the town would be paying in our contribution rate would be the 21.6%. That would be the total contribution rate. The employee then pays 7.65, so the normal cost for the employer is 13.95%. So that's the baseline of what the system believes is the cost to fund the retirement of a normal employee, a normal cost of the employee. So the amortization of the unfunded liability adds another 27.6% to our contribution rate, and that's where we get down to the 41.62 contribution rate just for the pension side. And so what that means for dollars is that the town pays $900,000 a year towards that normal pension cost. The employee is paying $500,000 towards their pension cost. And then the big number is the almost $2 million that the town is paying towards the amortization of that unfunded liability. So we've got that $24 million unfunded liability out there being amortized over now 17 more years. And their calculation is that we're contributing $1.9 million towards that unfunded liability. And again, that assumes that they hit their mark on all of their other assumptions, that you hit your interest rate of 7.3%, your payroll base grows by that 3.5%. So right. If you factor in all of those assumptions, they believe that over a 17-year period, then those rates would get us back to a 100% funded status for our pension systems.
Is the 7.65%, is that pretty standard among all municipalities and towns across the state?
Yes. For the PSPRS system, it's the 7.65%.
Okay. So looking through here, what you're saying is that if we were 100% funded, we would have a pot of that $1.947 million would be money that would be unallocated in the general fund. Can you give us some examples of budget items, departments that would be comparable to that $1.9 million a year? Like, well, to put it in the average citizen's hand, what does that buy?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Newell, I'm just looking at the budget for some of the general fund areas. Like Public Works budget is $4.8 million, so that 1.9 would be roughly 40 to 50% of the right. Public Works budget. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
as a comparison to other departments?
Just some things for citizens who are looking for, like, this is, you know, because we bought this, we couldn't buy a second one of these. Trying to give it context behind the size of the number.
The Parks and Recreation is $3.8 million, so it'd be roughly
like
half
of the Parks
and Recreation okay. Department.
Community Center, Parks and Recreation.
Right, the general fund portion right. of the general of the Parks and Recreation budget.
So we have been paying, based on the actuary, for the last 3 years, an attempted pay down on this underfunded pension liability, starting at a 20-year point, amortization, and we're now reducing it down so we're at 17 years. And during this entire period of time, the liabilities have continued to go up.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And we've actually been paying there's been a portion of our contribution rate that is amortizing the unfunded liability for more than the 3 years. It's been part of our contribution rate since we've been unfunded. But 3 years ago, the state required that we select this amortization period. We selected the 20 years versus the 30 years, and you're correct. With this report, we are now into it. We are 17 years left to amortize our unfunded liability. So again, one of the major areas that affect the funding status and our contribution rate is the asset support, and this is on page 14. I didn't include all years on this, just so that we would be able to see it and read it here. But basically, what this represents is the rate of return versus the assumed rate of return for each of the past fiscal years. So if we go back here, I'm sorry, let me just jump back. So if you look at 2013 and 2014, we had a rate of return of 10.9% and 13.2%. So you can see here, for those years, we have positive numbers. So because the rate of return was in excess of the 7.4%, that provided positive amortization for the system for that fiscal year. The other 4 years that we saw on that other schedule are the negative numbers, and so those are the years where the rate of return came in less than the assumed rate. So that 2016 number of $64 million is the year that we were at 0.9%. When the assumed rate was 7.4. So the way that they do that is instead of taking the 1 year's either positive or negative number and applying it to that fiscal year, they smooth it over 7 years. So they take 1/7 of every year's and come up with a smooth number. So for this fiscal year, the system was $166 million short, $160 million short of what they projected for their rate of return. So you take that $160 million, divide it by 7, and they allocate it over each year. So then there's $22 million that gets allocated to each year. So that $22 million is going to continue out for 7 years. And again, this table's on page 14 if you want to see the full table and the impact on it. So what gets amortized this year then is 1/7 of each of the past 7 years. So instead of taking the $160 million loss this year, they smooth it over 7 years, and we're taking the impact of a $53 million loss for this fiscal year. Next year, it would be $63 million, but then we'll add in whatever the results of next year is, whether it's a positive or a negative number. So that number could either go up or down based on the results of next year's number.
Are the rate of returns for PSPRS similar to the other state pensions? Is it?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Mason, there have been some years that they've outperformed ASRS. This current year, ASRS outperformed the public safety retirement system. So I think they're within the ballpark, but there are obviously differences between different systems and the rate of return.
So allow me to just apply something. So in what we would need in order for our asset rate to stay the same is to duplicate the performance from 2013 and 2020. Correct?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Newell, for that piece of the bucket,
yes,
correct.
That 1/7 of the bucket. So yes, that would be approximately, what was the percentage again that we would need to hit?
So 2000.
The
was it 10.9%?
10.9%.
And then to not have it go up again in 2021, we would need to hit 13.2%.
All other things being
even. All other things being even. So we couldn't expect growth to help us unless growth and the economic expansion continued through 2022-2023 fiscal. Is that correct?
Correct. So,
could be a big, because there was a large thing. If it did, it would make a very large difference.
Right.
All
so
that
if we
do is stabilize the unfunded liability.
Yes.
It's not going to eat into it.
No, it would just get there.
So you are correct. So if we had positive rate of return for these 2 years, then all things being equal, the rate would stay the same for that bucket.
Right.
If then the next 2 years out where we have these large negative numbers, you're again able to have a positive amortization, then it could make a significant difference because you're taking that $66 million or $64 million negative number and potentially making it a positive number where you could potentially have some positive amortization.
That would be a very long economic expansion, however.
That would be a very long economic expansion. Any other questions on the asset support or the rate of return?
You showed the impact of the reduced interest rate assumption. If it went, well, and this is actually in a combination of the CAFR and the actuarial report of reducing that interest rate assumption by 1%. And the net impact on that of changing the unfunded pension liability, as I recall, is somewhere around $8 million. Increases the unfunded pension liability by about $8 million, a 1% reduction in the assumed interest rate. So one of the things that this spreadsheet program, or maybe the flexibility that we would have in selecting something, might be assumed returns?
Mr. Chair, yes. That one of the variables that you can select on their model is the assumed interest or the assumed rate of return, and you can also project out for 20 years if you want to go in and project each year what you think the rate of return would be. It will update their model. I don't think there's a lot of value in that, honestly, but but you can go in and change the assumed rate of return, yes. And so just a finalize on this slide. So this $53 million is the impact to the system as a whole. The town of Oro Valley's piece of that is that 0.4%. And so it comes out to, I believe it was about $250,000 is what the town of Oro Valley is having to amortize, because over the 7 year period the system did not meet its rate of return. So for the next fiscal year, we have contributed the $500,000, so that helps to offset this negative impact of the rate of return of $250,000 loss to our asset base in the system. So that $500,000 goes towards that funding gap.
Can we put payment amounts in the model to see how it would impact, so we could get an idea?
Yes, so we can absolutely do. Again, I only had about 15 minutes to use the model today, and it seems like there is a bit of a drawback because I can go in and put some additional payments in, but what it does is it automatically offsets your contribution rate. And so it doesn't get you funded any quick. I haven't found an option where I can increase or put in annual contributions and keep our annual contribution rate the same and see when we would be funded by. It automatically assumes that if you're paying an extra $10 million over 20 years, that your rate goes down and you still get to a funded status of 100% by the 17-year period. So there may be some more variables that I can go in there and adjust, but I haven't found that yet. But I'll look at it further. So the report also does include an impact of additional contributions, and this is on page 8 of the report. And again, I summarized it here. The report shows it for each $1 million going out to $10 million. What I did here is, so if we do not make any additional contributions, our funded status is the 60.8% contribution rate of 41.65. If we made an additional $1 million contribution, then the funding status would go up to 62.4%, and again, our rate would then decrease to 40.54%. So this table just gives you a fixed period in time of June 30th, 2019, what would have happened if the town would have contributed different dollar amounts and what the impact would have been on our funded status and the impact on our contribution rate. So this isn't a live table. It's just as of that date, this would have been the impact.
Kevin, just taking that table for a second, when we're dealing with percentages, they can mislead you a little bit. And I'd like to deal in dollars for a second. Could you take that and put a return cost analysis together? I mean, I don't think you need to do it right at the moment. But if it said there, for example, that if you put $1 million into it and you reduce the funded status or reduce the contribution rate, what's the benefit we get by doing that against the cost of giving that money? Mm-hmm. Have you done that?
Yes. So our payroll base right now is approximately $6.9 million. So if you take the $6.9 million times our current contribution rate of 41.65, that's a payment that we'd be making of about $2.9 million. If the town were to make a $10 million payment and decrease our rate to 30.55%, our contribution to the system would be $2.1 million. So it's about a $770,000 decrease on an annual basis to pay $10 million. So your question was $1 million, so it would be about a $77,000 decrease in our annual contribution to make a $1 million payment.
So if you kept that $1 million, how much are you going to earn on it? I don't I'm not sure I know what the investment rates are.
I should be able to do that in my head, but I better not. I
mean, you're limited by statute as to the money market accounts. It's like you want it a quarter-ish.
I'm sorry?
I was just saying you're limited by statute as to what types of things we can reserve our funds in.
Yes, there is a state law that precludes us from investing in certain items. But currently, it would generate about $20,000 in investment return with our current investment portfolio.
So $1 million would generate a return of $50,000 on the reduction in the AREC. Doesn't sound like a lot.
And
5%.
There is also another option that the pension system or and state law is contemplating that would allow an individual town or city to establish a trust for your pension cost. So instead of contributing it to the pension system, we can set up, I think it's a Section 115 trust, so that we can control that trust. It's an irrevocable trust. So if we put, if council were to put money into it, it couldn't be taken back out for other operating expenses. But you're not actually giving it to the pension system. You're putting it in this intermediate trust that we would control, that then we can transfer the money to the pension fund at some later time. Honestly, I haven't thought through the process and what the benefits are completely to the town or the city, but it is another option that, that's potentially going to be out there.
Implication that the trust could then invest in things that the city couldn't?
Right.
And that's where the question would be, is would I don't know if we could be, if the town would be able to, one, if it wanted to, or number two, even if it could, be more aggressive than our current investment policy. But it, I guess in those years where you feel like maybe the pension fund had losses or very small increases, that maybe the town investing on its own could do better than what the pension system.
But they could potentially be used for the non-police fund to set up a reserve, because right now the employee fund does not have an individual trust for our employees.
There was a little bit of discussion on that, and there was not a representative from ASRS there, so PSPRS was just addressing how it would impact their fund. So I can't answer your question whether that could be used for the ASRS system or not.
Interesting. Well, I think it's interesting that the town is mandated to hold its investments in a money market rates or something similar, which probably is about 1.25% to 1.5%. But pension fund aims to get 7.4%, and looking forward at this point, that seems to be, I wish I knew where 7.4% return was, but I'm not sure I know.
And the town can be invested in other things besides money markets. I mean, we are invested in some commercial paper, U.S. agencies and treasuries. There is a list, but our rate of return right now is about 1.85%.
Is that what the local government investment pool is returning?
Mr. Chair, no. That we do have some funds in the LGIP pool, but we invest outside of the pool because we get a better return than the pool is getting. Okay, that's the end of my presentation. If you'd like to see the model, I can bring the model up so that you can see what that looks like.
Can you change employer or employee contributions, like in the model?
Commissioner Mason, you cannot change the employee portion or contribution rate. And I'm still trying to determine if the employer contribution rate is a variable that can be adjusted or held fixed.
Could the employee rate be increased?
Commissioner Mason, no. So back in 2013 or so, there was some pension reform, and they tried to change the allocation or the contribution between the employer and the employee, and it actually did change for 2 or 3 years. The system was sued.
It was a lawsuit.
It was the lawsuit, Parker Hall case, I believe was the name of it. And basically the towns had to refund all of those additional contributions that the employees made and then make up all of that difference. That's why when you look back, a big part of that increase in the actuarial liability went from $7 million up to $14 or $15 million in a couple of years was a result of some.
Now that you brought that up, I do remember that going on right before I left.
Okay, I'll just go over to the other computer there to run the model because the keyboard's. Okay, Mr. Chair, Commissioners, so again, this model does allow some variables to be changed, but I guess the important thing here, or the first thing to look at is on the estimated funded ratio, the dotted blue line there is what they estimate over the next 20-year period to happen based on their rates. So as you can see out there by 2036, they are projecting that the pension fund would be 100% funded for the Oro Valley Police Department. The graph right below it is our estimated contribution rates. And so you can see that they're showing them fairly stable there for 5 to 6 years. Again, the blue line, and then they start decreasing over time. Once the system hits its 100% funding status, then basically that amortization of the unfunded liability portion of the ACR goes away, and then you're just paying the normal cost for that.
How do you get there? I mean, the history we have shows that with the funding that we're doing, the unfunded liability continues to grow. What's changing on this that allows that change to occur?
Mr. Chair, the actuaries believe that they've made some changes to their assumptions, and also that the plan has made some significant changes. Tier 3, again, helping so that we're not continuing to add employees that have these same benefits. These new employees get reduced benefits, but they're still contributing towards this unfunded liability. So they believe that based on some of the structural changes that they've made to the system, that over time, over the 17-year period that we will get, that what they're projecting on their model is that we would get to 100% funded status. Again, if all the assumptions are met, meaning that we average 7.3% interest rate every year over that time, that the payroll base grows by that 3.5%. So again, there are some assumptions built into this and some assumptions that historically we have not hit. And so as you get out there further, if you continue to compound not meeting your mark on those assumptions, then your contribution rate is going to have to go up to make that difference up.
Then let me ask a clarifying question on new hires into the police department. It's my belief in looking at this thing that if a policeman does not have service prior to 2017, they would go in under a tier 3.
Correct.
So if you're going to hire a sergeant, who's got 10 years' experience. You're bringing him in under Tier 1 or Tier 2.
That would be correct. And there have been some discussions at communities about not hiring as many laterals and bringing in new recruits.
So these assumptions that are being made, for instance, for new hires, as the town grows, I assume we're going to need more policemen. Would all the new hires then be police officers that are do not have experience prior to 2017 to make this work?
Mr. Chair, even the Tier 3 employee or the Tier 3 members, part
of their...
That's
basically a defined contribution type plan, is it not? Or a cash balance type plan?
They have choices. They have options. They've got a hybrid option. But I believe most of them are choosing the same system that we currently have. But the Tier 3 members are also contributing to the unfunded liability. So their normal cost is different, but they still contribute 24% towards the unfunded liability. So, and that's on page 5 of the report. You can see the Tier 3 members and what their contribution is for the unfunded liability. So even as we bring on new recruits that are in Tier 3, the town is still paying, based on their salary, a contribution rate towards the unfunded liability for Tier 1 and Tier 2.
But I think what the chair is asking for is, do we have city policy that we're, as you indicated, some municipalities were having discussions on giving priority to Tier 3 hires rather than additionals, ones and twos?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Newell, there is no specific and set policy because it really is an operational decision on the part of the department to determine what holes do they need to be filled. Also, we only get so many slots in the academy every year, and so if that's our only place, we'll end up being behind. Mm-hmm. And so it is definitely a careful balance between, you know, do you want all rookies on your force? Do you need a combination? How many are we losing? Where do we need to fill? You know, those types of things. I will tell you that we don't bring in, for the most part, in fact, I don't believe we bring anyone in above a regular officer level. And we have a policy where we don't go that much higher in our salary. So we're only getting people in the first 5 years of service anyway for laterals, maybe 7 years, depending on where they might be coming from. So they're typically, they're not as, I mean, yes, are some of them in the Tier 1, 2? Yes, but I think that will change over time.
Okay.
And we won't see as many that will be in the Tier 1, 2 as far as laterals are concerned.
The reason I ask is I'm trying to determine if there are known. Obviously, we've been frustrated with the nebulousness of the problem here as the actuarial deficit has increased. Now that we have some more information, I'm trying to figure out if we have some known parameters that we can anticipate that we could mitigate against. Such as, we know that if most of our police hires are within their first 5 years, in 5 years from now, if those trends were to continue, we would not anticipate adding additional or very often tier ones and tier twos. But that may be something that we want to mitigate against for the next couple of years. Similarly, if we know the payroll is not going to increase 3.5%, that seems like something that is a known policy decision we're making that we could mitigate against, so that next year or the year after that, we're not surprised by an actuarial return.
anybody want to see more information on those charts?
So you've gone through this. So I'm assuming that the dotted blue line is what PSPRS is assuming that we're going to do, and then the red line would be those additional contributions and the table in the bottom left-hand corner?
Yes. And, I won't have a microphone, but I'll go over there and explain a little bit.
Okay. So this is what I was talking about when I was talking about. So I have included $500,000 payments down here, for the 10-year period. And so what that is doing, and I also changed payroll growth from 3.5% to 1%. So I've changed those two variables.
Okay.
The red line is with my variables that have changed. So you can see it doesn't change significantly on the top, on the funded status versus what the system is currently doing. But the reason for that is because the contribution rate starts decreasing. So you can see down here on the bottom one, the red line decreases because we're making these additional payments. It's saying, okay, the money's coming in over here, so the contribution rate can decrease. And so basically it's not changing much. We're still getting to a funded status by 2037 of 100% by making these changes, but it's because our contribution rate is going down.
Is the lower right graph, it looks like the legend is for dollars. Is that for dollars or for contribution rate? Or is that total contributions?
They're doing it for dollars in the millions. So currently they're showing $2.5 million is where it starts. It would go up to $3 million and then drop down up here in.
And that would be above the so that would be above the normal cost, or is that including the normal? That is the unfunded pay. That's the payments on the unfunded liability in the lower right hand corner.
Once we get to 100% funded status out here, that this becomes just normal cost.
Okay, so the normal cost is down there.
And so that's why I think it would be helpful if there's a variable that I can change so that we can show those additional payments and it doesn't decrease our contribution rate, so that you can see by making those additional payments how much quicker do we get to 100% funded status. Because their model is basically just assuming it's coming in over here, so it's decreasing it here, so it still gets funded by the same time.
Right. I guess this is, you know, my general long-term concern is their model is going to make sure that within the 20 years, we're going to hit 100%. And what I don't want to have happen to the town is we have some sort of cascading tidal wave where the contribution rate just gets higher and higher, and all of a sudden it starts squeezing the general fund for programming. Is that the idea is that we could pay earlier, and then we would have not as much of a squeeze in future years as we get closer to that 20-year period?
Commissioner, no, that's exactly right, and they talked about that at the training, that you know if you get to year 16 and we're almost fully funded and then you have a bad return on investments or a negative, that then you only have 1 year to amortize that, and you're going to have to make it up in that 1 year period. I agree. I think the current pension funding policy of contributing $500,000 a year, I mean, I think that's a reasonable approach right now. Get a couple of years of data behind us so that we can see what the impact of that is. If the system does allow us to change some of those variables going in and make some of those changes, I think that's a reasonable approach, as you mentioned, to try to mitigate having significant contribution rate increases in later years. Trying to make some of those payments now so that we can try to keep that contribution rate fairly level. I personally think that is a reasonable goal of our pension funding policy, is trying to manage the rate over the next 20 years.
Just a thought. The current amount for the unamortized right now is 2.8 million if you count employer costs and the the amortization of the unfunded. By making additional payments, like you said, we make the $500,000 payment, but then they reduce the contribution rate. So if we said, well, if we try to keep a consistent amount of payment, in other words, you know, use 2.8 as an example, you know, we make our payment to stay at around that $2.8 million in total every year. Even though our contribution rate may go down for a bit, we're still kind of keeping the contribution rate stable. And so for a period of time, we're paying kind of a fixed amount. So we're kind of getting the benefit of making an extra payment. Mm-hmm. And also we're kind of keeping a pretty steady payment, you know, over the years. And then you could try that for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and you're going to look at it every year anyway. And maybe at a five-year point, you could see, are we gaining, are we losing, are we gaining more? Maybe we can taper back a little bit because we're really gaining on the 100%. At least that would be from a budgeting concern. You'd have a stable amount that you're kind of paying each time. So it seems to me that could be at least an option to think about.
Is there a way of taking that, just dovetailing off of that, and instead of the $500,000, find a way of taking the current employer cost, which is almost $2.9 million, and then adding to it another number, for the sake of argument, $1 million. And keeping it at that level and see what happens to it, to create a series of interim targets in terms of dollars of unfunded liability.
Are you talking in the model to attempt? Yes. Yeah, I think that would be a very reasonable approach to, as Commissioner Mason said, try to keep that contribution rate stable. Once we can get that contribution rate going down on an actuarial basis, right, the town would have the opportunity to keep it level in our budget and continue to make those payments to get it paid off even quicker.
Right.
I'm not sure I can do that in the model yet, but that is what
maybe
I'm looking
just
to.
You need to monkey around with the model.
Exactly.
This seems like something you're going to use your Excel skills for. And
I don't know if I'm assuming they have it password protected and locked down. I will have to go in and see which variables that we can change. But I believe if I can get the model to show that we can make additional payments and keep the contribution rate fairly flat so that you can see what the impact to the funding status is.
You think you would start gaining because making the same, even though you, year one, you know, it may be this amount, year two it goes down, but you're going to keep it up. So in essence, you're making more than a $500,000 additional payment.
Right. Yeah. So if you straight. And you could, if you, right now your cursor's over the 2020 at 500,000, right? left there. So you could, you know, eyeball it at 650 and 850 and 1,050,000 or whatever it was to kind of eyeball it at what keeps the red line straight over time, right? So you just want to make sure that every year is kind of, you understand, it's like, okay, it went down, so it's just like, what?
Well, and so what I did there is I just put a $10 million payment into year one, and you can see the same thing happens.
Right.
It gets you to funded status of 100%.
At the same time.
So it's calculating the delta that's required for the present value of all the, it's saying, okay, if you pay $10 million, then the present value next year is this amount, and it's dividing that by 16.
And so then the contribution rate goes down significantly once we make that $10 million payment. So the model is that it's not giving us a lot of options.
Well, it's give you the option of paying off in 2039, regardless of what you do.
Exactly. What the model is doing is it's saying, no matter what you do, come 2039, you'll be paid off. Whether you pay the $24 million up front or you pay it off over time. And again, maybe there's other things that I can adjust in the model so that when we come back next time that it's more interactive and we can...
Yeah, my thought is that, you know, where that 2020 is and you just put the 10 million, you know, if we had the 500,000 and then maybe it's 650 and then it's 800 and then it's sort of like your principal versus interest on your mortgage basis. So you know that you're making the same payment, but more of it's going off on the principal all the time. Mm-hmm. So you would need to increase each of those numbers down and then visually represent on the lower right to make sure that red line is straight. And then the fund ratio would, I assume, would plummet and hit before 2036. Because you'd hit zero beforehand if you just kept
if
increasing.
If I can get it to where it won't adjust the ACR.
Yeah.
Because right now it's just automatically adjusting that so that it gets us funded in 17 years.
Yeah. My guess is if you continued adding yearly contributions that were big enough, it would you'd get to the zero. You'd get to fully funded quicker before the 36. Right, but then you just keep going until you hit the zero, and then it's like, oh, it's here. Right. We don't need to go anymore.
Yep.
Yeah, so if you did it again, then it's going to hit...
But that's true with that, but that's unrealistic.
Yeah, it's unrealistic.
Basic question there is that whether it's 500,000 or a million, at this point, to be able to get the council something by, which I think our intent is March, what's the budget for next year going to allow us to put it? Have you gotten that far?
We are just in the beginning stages of doing the revenue projections, and we won't get the departmental budget submittals until early next month. And so, you know, we're just starting that process. So the answer is no, we haven't made that, you know, determination, but that's why we wanted to start having this conversation with you earlier, because what will happen, of course, is that the pension funding policy will end up being on the same agenda with the town council's final budget adoption. So they will be hand in hand. And so, you know, getting your recommendation, and that will move forward to council. And of course, you know, as staff, we may or may not be on the same page as far as a recommendation. I'm hoping that we will.
Guess probably 10 million is not.
10 million might not be exactly the number I was thinking about. So if that's where you're headed, we probably won't be on the same page.
Just thinking out loud.
Right.
So, you know, what alternative? I mean, just there's two issues here, as I say. At first, there's the issue of this year, this coming year. What is it that we want to advise? And make a recommendation to the council. But the second one is long term. What are we going to do? You know, if whatever the number may be next year may not be enough or may be too much to be able to accomplish what the policy is saying. We just don't know that. And I think that's where this might come in with a little bit of benefit if it can be made more flexible. But we have in front of us a month, one more meeting to be able to determine what we're going to recommend to the council.
I've given a lot of thought to this over the past couple weeks, and I guess how I've kind of analyzed how this policy works is that we budget a specific amount in the budget because we anticipate that their actuarially or formulas aren't really enough to make the dent. And I think we said we'll try 500,000 and see as a lump sum early if that was going to make, you know, basic, you know, act as the buffer for the known shortfalls that we could anticipate.
So that the actuarial, so that the rate would be about the same year after year. And I think we've learned today that you know, the payroll growth is a known thing that we can account for. So if I was thinking for next year, I would probably think for the known, you know, the known maintenance level of let's budget something for that year. It would be the continue the $500,000 or perhaps a small increase, and then an additional separate payment for the payroll growth. That would be determined by what the chief and the town manager determined is, you know, if we know we're not going to get the 3.5%, we can plan for it. And then when we think about making additional payments to hit the principal, I still think it's more appropriate for that to come back on our reserves that's unallocated. We have those anticipated things that would come at the end of the budget cycle. And that's current policy right now is to use those in addition to capital. But I was thinking maybe some additional guidelines as to how, what the ratio of that should be between capital and what we'll call principal payments on the PSPRS. And one of the reasons I think that's more appropriate is this actuarial deficit was something that was created in the past. And the surpluses we've had and the, I don't want to say surpluses, but I want to say our, what's the proper term here? Our fund balances in these were things that were accumulated in the past. So I'd like to see our future monies, since we're trying to balance things out and you know, to talk about generational equity, it seems like the things that we've accumulated in the past should be used to attack the principal of the debts we've made in the past, whereas we should use the best information we have going in the future to try to take a guess to keep things level. Does that make sense?
I think what I'm hearing you say is you want to kind of keep the timing, keep the liabilities you're going to incur the same as at the same time as what the revenues you're bringing in. I don't know if that makes sense. But, for example, this liability of the pension, it's for the police officers that are protecting us today.
Right.
And so we want to pay for that today. But we've got this huge debt from 20 years ago. And I think what you're saying is we've also, we were able to accumulate some surplus dollars because our revenues have exceeded our expenditures and we've got this bucket so we can use that to pay off those liabilities that have we've incurred over the past 10, 20 years. Is that kind of what you're saying? And once we catch up, and then we're just at normal.
Let me make a couple of comments on the funding policy also. I think it's probably important for the town to have relatively flat payments, if possible. Mm-hmm. Easier to budget for, easier to anticipate, probably easier to digest. So we're probably not talking about a couple of $10 million pieces. We're talking about something a lot less. Okay, so that's probably issue one. Issue two for me is that I think these unfunded pension liabilities are a very serious problem that we can't ignore for a lot of reasons. Looking at the CAFR, it appears to me that the unfunded pension liabilities are, relatively speaking, the same size, if not greater, than the debt that the town has, bond issues, et cetera, that it's issued for other things, just to put it in perspective. Also, to put it in perspective, rating agencies and investors, up until now, and maybe not even quite yet, haven't known what to do with these unfunded pension liabilities relative to rating a bond, relative to selling a bond. But what is starting to happen is that because of the unique position of municipalities and state constitutions, municipalities are not able to get rid of these unfunded liabilities via bankruptcy. So people who are buying bonds, municipal bonds, are all of a sudden finding themselves not as secured as they originally thought they would be. And I think this trend will continue forward because our issue with unfunded pension liabilities is just a microcosm of what's going on out there in municipalities and states throughout the country. So we got to do something about it. That brings me to this point of within our existing policy where we say we are adopting financial policies dedicating surplus funds toward reducing the liability. To me, when someone says surplus funds, and by the way, I've never seen any municipality really create surplus funds. There's always a way to spend it for population use. But when you say surplus funds, it converts the unfunded pension liability to a want, not a need.
Great.
And I think we have a need. So I think some of the terminology in here has to elevate this unfunded liability and the cash flow stream that's necessary to fund it into a need, and it puts it into a comparable situation for other things that are in the budget, whether they be parks or cars or whatever they might be. I think having to take care of this liability is a fairly critical thing for the town. That being said, what I'd like to see also in this is a focus on the dollars, not just the percentages, and to create interim targets as to how we're going to get there. Unfortunately, based on history and based on knowing that actuarial reports have an awful lot of moving targets to them, I'm not really confident that is a line that we should have any confidence in. So I think we have to take charge of some of this stuff ourselves as a town and make sure that those police officers, et cetera, can rely on that money when it's needed, and that we as a town have a balance sheet, even though this might not be exactly as a known liability to a specific entity like a bond, but we as a town are addressing the issue and are serious about it. Any comments?
So are you suggesting we add this as a budgeted line item included in the budget for 2021?
Absolutely. But I'm suggesting that we rip out this line item that shows surplus funds. We clarify the amortization of these unfunded liabilities, which I find this right now is a little cloudy. And you know what? Last year when we were put into this situation, we were a new group. This was a new issue. I can't say it was a new set of disclosures, but as a new commission, we really hadn't been exposed to this before. So I think it was a decent attempt at a policy, but I think it needs a lot of work. And I think we need to make a recommendation as to what, in general, what that flat line type of additional contribution should be that would work within the budget and have it elevated within the budget.
Because I was wondering if you've already budgeted $500,000 and was paid. Excuse me. Let's say we actually budgeted in the budget every year $1 million. You make one payment up front of $500,000. Then before the end of the year, end of the fiscal year, you know, a decision could be made if there are other issues that spring up that were that resulted in, you know, the need for the $500,000 to be put on something else, you'd have that option. You could use it, either not spend it and keep it for the next year to do something, or go ahead and apply the $500,000 at the end of the year if you need, you know, to make it $1 million every year. The other thing I was trying to look at here is if, regardless of what we pay, try to maintain, from a dollar perspective, a consistent contribution rate. So whatever rate we think of, if we want to stay at, if we think 41, then if it goes down next year to 36, you know, we could look at, because we've made payments to meet that 41% contribution rates in the past. So if we keep the dollar value equivalent to that 41%, regardless of what the contribution rate is, if it tends to go down, then we're kind of gaining ground there, and we're also having an amount that we're budgeting that's pretty consistent from year to year. Now, for some reason, the contribution rate goes crazy, then obviously you have to look at it, but maybe there's a couple options there. Instead of creating a budget for an additional payment, try to keep our payment at whatever, $3 million, even though from a contribution viewpoint, it may go down to 2.5 one year, we're still making $3 million. If it goes lower, whatever, try to keep that constant so that, you know, it's a known that we can cover it because we have been covered in the past. So I guess that's a couple different ways, I guess, to look at it.
Yeah, I think the only known is that that's unknown.
Well,
and it's going to change. And interest rates are going to go up and down, returns on investment.
It's unknown, but it's but we have some numbers to work with.
Yep.
It's unknown, but we know. You could take the value and divide it by 17 and say, okay, that, you know, we probably should be paying at least that amount. You know, I mean, there's, we can't use unknown as an excuse not to make some decisions. And I think I agree with you. I think we do need to have a number. You know, you did $500,000 last year. Can we afford $1 million? You know, I don't know. If I'm just concerned if we don't put something in that's a budgeted line item that kind of starts to attack it, it's like a credit card bill. It could keep.
Well, I
stop the growth of that liability.
Right.
We need to see that we're at the top of where it is now, and it starts down. I mean, we owe that to,
right. Well, to we know that the next 2 years we're going to be in stressed because of the 2 years, the two good return years that are coming off. I guess the two. I think again, I'll go back to, I think our policy works if, as the additional fund balances contribute, that before staff and council decide to buy more things or buy more services, they realize that there is the first thing they should pay off with a target of 10% or 20% of, rather to go to capital, is to give some sort of ratio that they're going to fund towards PRS. If the number I would be curious at when we're talking about what is our contribution rate, if since we gave an extra $500,000 this year, what would that, what was our effective contribution rate with the additional $500,000?
Great.
So,
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Newell, the our contribution rate is not changing at this point with this additional
$500,000. The thought is that the $500,000 is an effective contribution rate because this $500,000 would be considered part of the payment.
In addition to that. So instead of being 41, did we pay an extra 6%?
50.7. So 3.5, okay. Right? 3.5 divided by 6.9. Payroll base is 6.9 million, and you paid 3.5? So 50.7%.
Okay.
So basically what you're saying is we added another 10% contribution rate on the part of the town. Now, I can tell you, as you know, our rate is already going up. That is already an additional $150,000 next year to the town's budget without doing one thing.
Right.
So this is a long game here, okay? This is why the policy is going to come back for reevaluation every single year. And if I may, you know, suggest that I want to remind the commission of two things. First of all, this is a policy. It is not a procedure. Okay. So as you're going through this, I ask you to keep it at that 20,000 foot level, at that policy level, and not get into the minutiae of the how and, you know, that sort of thing. Keep it at that policy target. Here's where we want to be. Here's the target. And to remember that this is a one-year policy and that it's going to be reevaluated every year. And I think having those goals, there are some very clear goals in the policy. Council's committed to 100% fully funded. You know, I mean, those are those goals that I think will absolutely stay the same. And there are, again, some very basic goals in there. Maintain the ARC payments from operating revenues. You know, maybe that's where you can add something in there, and at the point where the contribution goes down, continue to maintain it at its higher level. You know, that would be a great policy statement right there that says the same thing. Like, you know, if your mortgage payment goes down, you still keep paying it at the higher level because you know it just goes to the principle, exactly. So, you know, looking, this is the foundational policy that communities across the state are utilizing. And while ours can be slightly different, and I'm not, and it already is, I would encourage you to use this as the framework rather than us starting from scratch and figure out what isn't working, what do we want to change that's different. And, you know, and what is it that you want to communicate to the council in that regard? Because, and I've heard you all say it here on the dais, this is a balance issue. We want to achieve that goal. We absolutely do. Couldn't agree with you more. But it's a marathon, not a sprint. And we also have core services that we have to deliver. And that's our primary purpose for existing. And while I appreciate the comments that our chairman made about this issue becoming more prevalent and you know, communities filing bankruptcy, the facts of the matter is we've got, as I recall from the last time I looked at it, 30,000 municipalities across the country, and less than 200 have filed for bankruptcy. So it's not, and we're not going to be one of them. So I don't want us to worry about that. That is such a teeny tiny itsy bitsy little thing in the grand scheme of things. We just want to get this paid on time without jeopardizing the investments we need to make as a community, without jeopardizing the services that we need to provide to our residents. So, you know, that balance is what we're looking for here, and I think you all are right on the track in terms of your conversation.
So as far as the policy that you have down here, I'm fine with it, but that last item where you say apply adopted financial dedicating surplus funds, is there something that we could be somewhat, I don't know, are you looking for like a dollar amount that we would recommend to put in there, or
a percentage?
Or what? Because surplus just seems to be, you know,
funds.
If you want to, I guess, what would you be looking for in there to make this one? Because I think here it's too up in the air, because surplus could be, you know, defined by the person who's trying to make the argument. So if you're always waiting for a surplus, you may not have a surplus because you have other things you want to do in the town. So do we want to put a specific amount above the contribution rate or above our normal, what we're paying now?
Well, that's already in the policy on the very, very last page, the last bullet, where it says, budget an additional payment toward the unfunded liability debt as part of the annual budget process on top of the employer contribution based on funding availability. And, of course, that's always the case, right?
So basically we could probably leave out the one bullet on the bottom of page two and just add. So in other words, you'll say every year we're going to budget a certain amount, whatever that amount may be. Then that amount could vary from year to year, especially if this is an annual policy. So because basically you're saying we're going to budget an amount. That amount could be $500,000. It could be whatever you decide to be going through the budget process.
Sure. And you know, it could say minimum of, it could, I mean, those are some of the words that you may want to consider.
Would you like a range?
Absolutely. I think that
500 to a million or something like that.
I think that would be very appropriate. And we could take out that other bullet. I think, again, last year was the first time that we did the policy. And that bullet simply reflects the town council's financial policies, which are in their, that's adopted by separate resolution. But you're right, they're a little bit duplicative. We'll do that anyway. But I think what you're getting at is exactly what we did this fiscal year was we included it as part of the budget process. It was identified as a line item, and we funded it at the $500,000 level. And so I think that would be a great place, that bullet right there, to maybe talk about what do you all recommend it should be.
Because if we
the
give
range,
a range,
the minimum.
It gives you flexibility based on what's happening at the time of the budget preparation.
Right.
I guess I would still like to see another line item in the budget to reflect the payroll, the known payroll adjustment once your staffing comes through with the police. So if we know that we're going to have a shortfall because we're only growing payroll 1% instead of 3.5%, we should be able to account for that and add that as a separate, right?
I just want to be clear also that one slide that showed the adjustments to the contribution rate,
right?
Because the payroll base didn't meet that 3.5%, we are already paying additional amount next year,
right?
Because our contribution rate is going up because of that,
right?
So
we'll double count. If what you're saying is we'll count it one way and then we'll add it again. I think my recommendation to you is what Mr. Art said, which is focus on an additional above amount, because our contribution rate is going to, we anticipate our unfunded liability continuing to increase for a couple more years until we can get it stabilized. And I think we need to just be prepared for that based on what we're seeing in terms of, you know, we've got a new actuary, they're going to be doing some new numbers, and all of the other things that Kevin went over earlier. But the good news is that the structural issues have been resolved. And so now we have to, as we contribute more, we'll see that take effect in the future. And then whatever our rate is going to be at that point, I agree with you, we should sustain that. And that will be that additional amount, even though we could reduce our rate, we keep it up there, and that's that additional payment, even beyond a lump sum, that we can live with, right? Live with, and then over time, as we see that rate go down, we might be able to reduce it, and that frees up money for, obviously, new staff, or whatever it is that we need at that point, based on the needs of the community.
I assume you don't want to consider new taxes or anything like that that might bring in new revenue to help cover this, whether it be a sales tax. I'm not sure if property tax would be an option, but is that, I know both of those are unfavorable type things, but has that been discussed, or is that something that you might, I guess that could be a fallback point if we're just really losing ground on this thing.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Mason, I don't believe that we are at the position where we need to consider an alternate revenue source. I believe that we have time. We've got, you know, almost 17 more years in order to continue to make progress toward this. And so I would reserve those types of ongoing sales tax increases, not if they were ever to happen. I wouldn't recommend it to council that we consider it at this point, because I don't think that there's the story behind us needing to do it.
Would a, if, just a question, if property tax was an option, does that require a voter approval, or can council approve it?
Voter approval.
Okay. But sales tax, council could increase it without voter approval. Okay, thank you.
Correct. And I will say that the strategic leadership plan has identified a review of our fund sources, and I think that that's something with our new chief financial officer that we will want to bring back to you maybe later in the summertime to help us evaluate where are we, where do we compare, how do we, you know, our major fund sources, and at that point you may have some recommendations for council, but I would consider that separately and do that with our five-year forecast and that sort of thing down the line.
So based on what you know about next year so far, is $500,000 to $1 million reasonable, affordable, as an additional amount?
I think that that range gives me some flexibility to, work in what it is that we can afford. Yes.
Because the last thing we want is to get within, say, 5 years and still have, an $18 million liability. I mean, that would be, how do you get out of that? How do you dig out of that one, right? So I would just be concerned, are we putting enough down so that we're not going to have a problem? And I know we have 17 years, and that's good. It's all, and I also feel like I've certainly learned a lot tonight, Kevin. I think you explained it very well, and I feel like we've all got a much better understanding. So in terms of like year one of kind of getting this under your belt, I think we all understand a little bit or a lot better what the issues are and what impacts what in terms of the numbers and the liability. So that's kind of step one. So that's good, and thank you. But I just would want to make sure that we've got time on our hands, and we want to make sure we take advantage of it by making sure that we start drawing down that liability.
Commissioner Salverson, I agree with you, of course, which is why I included an additional payment last fiscal year. I do think that it is prudent for us to make this a priority. I also think that it's prudent for us to understand that this is part of our long-term process and to do this wisely and in a way that is sustainable. And that's obviously the most important thing when it comes to local government. And so if we start seeing our liability go down, that is a really good sign, because it means that the contribution rate that we will be paying in that large percent, it's more than half of what we pay in our contribution rate goes to the unfunded liability. So if it's going down and we continue to make some additional increases or contributions toward it, then that rate is going to reflect it going down, because most of what's in that rate that we're paying for the officers is going directly to paying down the liability. True. So we have to get there. But if we say our rate go up, let's pretend over the next 2 years it goes up to 45%. Just, I'm making this up because I don't really know. 45% for every single sworn officer is a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And so then it's that careful balance between what can we afford, and as long as we see progress, as long as we can see some results in the end, that our liability is going to stop growing and reduce, then I think that's a big win on our part. It really is.
So, following up with what you're recommending, Kathy, maybe we should come up with a range in our recommendation. Maybe we can depend upon Kevin to come back at the next meeting with a recommendation in that area once he's able to rifle through this program, because mm-hmm. I'd like to know if we make a recommendation of a particular range, we'll rely upon staff to tell us how that fits into the budget, but also what does that do for the future? I mean, it gives us some idea of where the guardrails are being set up. So if we say 500 to a million, you know, what does that mean? At least based on the limitations that we have with what this tool has given us. Kevin, am I stepping out of line? Does that sound reasonable to you?
No, Mr. Vice Chair, that was the plan. Staff was planning on bringing back a recommendation at the next meeting based on some of the feedback that we got here tonight.
Yeah, I think I just want to make sure that we know that when you make that recommendation, what are the long-term impacts of this step that we're putting in there based upon, I mean, what are the assumptions that you're putting in there? If you can change assumptions and you come up with this amount, that might be different. So it's just understanding that if we make this recommendation to the council, what do they need to be prepared to be aware of, if anything? That's my only concern. But I think we're looking at a range as being something that's very doable.
I have one more quick question for Kevin. So the tier threes, is that reflected in the total amount, the total obligation? So in other words, I assume that once you get out 20 years, the pension cost relatively, you know, percentage-wise or relatively, is going to be lower, right? That's one action to reduce those costs. So is that reflected in the estimates, which are like that anyway?
So the Tier 3s are similar to our ASRS plan. It's okay. Not... We don't have a separate trust for Oro Valley Tier 3s. All Tier 3s across the state, every department is in its own trust, one single trust for everybody, just like ASRS is. So we only have our own separate trust for the Tier 1 and the Tier 2 employees.
Okay.
So we won't have an individual liability like this for our Tier 3. It's a pooled group of all employees.
So basically it's the legislature's problem, not ours.
Well, we still have to make our contribution rates towards it. And I mean, it
cost would be less.
Ours, not.
But as your tier one and two get through retirement, then
it'll drop off.
It becomes less expensive.
Right. So that's like another thing to think about once you get to that point.
Which will be then. 2039.
We'll
be
I have a couple of recommendations on the current wording to this funded policy. On page 2, where we've got PSRPS and Corp funding goal, it currently reads, pensions that are less fully funded place the cost of service provided in earlier periods, amortization of UAAL, on the current taxpayers. I think that really should read on current and future taxpayers. I would recommend that
right here
near the bottom, the second bullet that currently reads retain 20-year amortization of unfunded liability rather than extend to 30 years as allowed by statute. Just simply be more positive and say retain 20-year amortization of unfunded liability, period.
Do you want to put a date on that so it's clear what the termination date on the amortization is?
There are other things here where we say 100% fully funded by June 30, 2036. Okay. So it'd probably be redundant if we change that. The last bullet here on this page 2 that reads apply adopted financial policies dedicating surplus funds, I'd eliminate that altogether. Because on the last bullet, on the next page that reads, budget an additional payment toward the unfunded liability debt as part of the annual budget process. So that changes it from a want to
a need.
Sure.
I'm good with that.
On top of the employer contribution. And then period. Delete based on funding availability. And then say for fiscal year 2021, this should include a lump sum of
whatever we decide.
Right.
Okay. A million, whatever the number is going to be that you would come back to us, and we could use that then as a foundation, I think, to try to create some type of a level payment system for
right.
this
I,
thing.
I definitely think the big addition from our last policy was to start budgeting an additional payment.
Right.
That was key.
Absolutely.
I still like the idea of if economic good times continue for an extra year and we have unanticipated resources.
We could throw more money at
it. I still believe that we shouldn't remove the goal of using some of that unanticipated resource towards pension fund. I would actually like to strengthen it a bit and say adopt a goal of the first X percentage of those funds to go back towards...
This is where I think we can put a range in.
Yeah.
Because I think we have to be careful about fund balance and saying we want to use a certain percentage, because fund balance is there for a reason to meet
right. Well,
I think if we just put a range in there, whatever range we want to put in there, that establishes.
Even if you said we were going to prioritize what I'm hesitant to do by removing it is just saying, oh, we have extra money. Let's spend it all. I would like to pay off or have some basis in policy that a percentage of that as a target should be used to also make an additional payment past what we budgeted for beyond what we were required to by our contribution rate. So we're paying the contribution rate in full over 20 years. Great. We're budgeting every year at the beginning of the budget cycle something in addition to that. Fantastic. If we have extra money at the end, I'd still like a second bite at the apple and strengthen
that. Define that in here.
The thing is, you have to have that budgeted too. So if you don't know if it's not budgeted, then you can't make the payment. So
Could you put a, would something saying like 10% of the first $2 million of excess funds to be spent should be designated towards the PSPRS. So if you anticipate that you're going to have $2 million extra that you would choose between PSPRS and capital, could you put a percentage goal on there to say let's spend $1.8 million on capital and $200,000 on pension?
Well, again, the surplus is estimated during the budget process.
That's correct.
So right now, between now and March, we're going to estimate
yep.
what we believe that surplus is. Then we will show that estimated surplus to council, and it will get allocated between capital and this $500,000 million additional payment. So I do think it was actually a duplicate to have these in here, because that additional payment is coming from the surplus. Because as Commissioner Mason mentioned, we can't just take the surplus and make a payment because we haven't budgeted for
right.
that. And so I think taking it out and strengthening the language on the last bullet point
yep.
to say that we will budget have a range in there so that there is some flexibility. I think that makes the most sense. Because I do think that second to the last bullet point creates some confusion on what is that surplus, when is it going to get paid. And I think it was trying to identify that whatever we estimate as that surplus, a portion of that will be budgeted that next year. And that's what we did with the $500,000. So that was coming from the prior year's surplus.
I have another question that just popped in my head. So the ARC, is that going to be reduced every year based on if we pay ahead? Is it going to look like that lower right graph? Is that how it like works in real life? Or you know what I'm saying?
I wish you could have been at the conference, because there was quite a bit of discussion on that, because one individual from the system said that those additional contributions are just going in and then reducing your ARC. So it's really not paying down your liability, because you make that $500,000 payment, and now they have more funds in there, and then they're just going to reduce your contribution rate. The other person said, no, 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 it does reduce your liability. So there wasn't clear direction.
So we don't know.
And so that might be one of the benefits of that additional, that separate trust that we talked about.
Right.
Because then we could put the money to the side. They don't get it. Then they would still calculate the contributions without that $500,000 in there. So it would keep the ARC higher. So as I was talking through that, that may be one of the benefits of establishing that additional trust, mm-hmm. because we can put the money in there, but then PSPRS isn't going to calculate those funds when they calculate the ARC.
Can you bring us more information on that next meeting? Because I think that might be a very good option to kind of look at.
Yeah, it's very preliminary at this point, but yes, okay. I can get you some of the additional preliminary information, but I don't believe that's going to happen for a year or two out. Yeah. But
I mean, if we were disciplined enough to, you know, obviously pay our ARC, but continue to increase the additional payment as the ARC went down, you would have the same result, as long as we are disciplined enough to do it.
But right now, with the current way that we've got this written, I don't think that's the case, right? Right now, with the way it's written, if the ARC goes down, we're not going to be paying level amounts year over year. We're going to be paying less every year, because the more we pay down our liability, they're going to recalculate it, it sounds like, maybe, and so we'll be paying less. We'll have to bump up our principal amount or you know, our amount every year, right? $500,000 won't cut it because we're paying less.
So kind of setting
a total goal. What's the total we're paying?
A total goal and our own percentage of
total toward the unfunded liability, right?
Yes, we could make that amendment to the policy to make it clear that if the ARC minimum ARC from PSPRS is
drops,
going down,
right,
that our policy is that we'll continue to fund the same dollar amount.
I think that's reasonable, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a feeling it's going to look like that if that's the way the model was designed.
I hope we get to that point very soon where that contribution rate actually does start going down, because it does mean that the liability is going down and we're making progress on it. That'll be a good problem to have to try to figure out that delta and make sure that we make that additional payment, because that means we will have hit the top of that liability and we're actually on the
paying down.
I'm paying it down.
You will come back to us at the next meeting with a little bit of a wordsmith policy and see if you can figure that puppy out.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, the town manager and I were just talking. We'll have to run it by our legal services department, but we're thinking maybe we could have like a work session or a study session so that we can be in a smaller conference room and actually go through the model. So it'd be easier for everyone to see. And so if that's something that the commission would like, we can follow up, see if that's something that we could do. But that way we could plug in some of the variables and see what happens after I've had a chance to see how the model works.
And then maybe we'd be more comfortable with the 500,000 to a million, right? If we could see it reducing.
Well, you've done an admirable job wrapping your hands around this tool in less than 3 hours. So thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Then what we would anticipate then at the next meeting would be the follow-up on that, and then the commission making a recommendation on the policy.
Yes.
Anything else on this? Okay. Future agenda items?
So staff's plan is would just be to have the pension funding policy as the next agenda item. There'll be a monthly update. Other than that, I can't think of anything else that we would have that staff would be bringing forward.
What about the other pension plan? I know it's not a trust, but just in terms of
we could have a, if you think we could knock out the majority of the discussion on the PSPRS before that next meeting, either at a work session, then yeah, we staff could present at least the actuarial report on the ASRS pension plan. If you think that's too much for one night, then we could do it at the next meeting. But I mean, we could put it on there, and if you wanted to table it till the next meeting, if
because I think it'll just be an informational piece.
Correct.
Yeah, I wouldn't put too much. Well, I don't want to say not to put too much work in, but I think it's more of an informational piece and just making sure we have the right information so that we can be familiar with the potential moving forward. But that's about it.
Okay.
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you very much.